The Curtain of Time. Time is an invisible curtain separating the past from the present. This is Harlow Wilcox inviting you to join me as we draw aside the curtain of time to meet some men who showed exceptional ingenuity in the face of death. But first, down through the ages, men condemned to die have offered themselves for all manner of dangerous deeds and experiments. No doubt in some cases the men are truly repentant and sincerely wish to give a final service to humanity. But many a man has volunteered with his tongue in cheek and the thought of what can I lose in his mind, hoping that everything will turn out all right and the grateful public will give him back his life. But whatever his motive, the results are sometimes satisfactory to the condemned man and to the world, and sometimes more far-reaching than anyone anticipated. Two such willing young men were Carl and Olaf Eriksson, twin brothers who were condemned to death for murder during the 18th century in Sweden. Their being identical twins was the cause of their both waiting for the hangman. Only one of them had been noticed at the scene of the crime, but nobody could tell which one it was. Since in those days a suspect was deemed guilty until proven innocent, both were doomed to face the executioner. One concession was granted them. Since they had been born at the same time and were to die at the same time, they were allowed to share the same death cell. The condemned men tried to work out a method of escape. The walls were too thick for any pair of hands to break. Digging their way out was equally impossible. Their food was handed them through a narrow opening, so overpowering the guard was out of the question. And they had no money with which to bribe the guards. The day of hanging drew near. Carl and Olaf realized that for them there was no escape. With all hope gone, they fell to brooding. Their brooding led to bitter arguments. They quarreled about whose fault it was that they were about to be hanged. They dug up childhood quarrels that had long since been almost forgotten, Olaf even remembering the time he had been punished for a theft of some pastry Carl had stolen. When they wore out their personal arguments, they turned to the subjects which at the time were dividing the public. Coffee and tea had recently been introduced into Sweden. The coffee drinkers were sure their beverage was a veritable elixir, while tea was at least a poison. The tea drinkers were equally sure their beverage was perfect, while coffee was the drink of fools. Carl and Olaf brought the battle of the beverages to their cell. The argument became quite bitter, and they had almost come to blows when the guard came to prepare them for the execution. Suddenly, Carl became silent, and the ghost of a smile flickered across his face. Then he turned to the guard with a question. As men who are about to die, do we not have the right to have our last wish fulfilled? The guard nodded. Then I wish to be taken to the king. Well, at first his demand was refused, but the condemned man insisted upon his rights. Finally, the head jailer was called and told of the impossible request. Carl was called into the warden's office and questioned. The prisoner gave a vague reason for wishing an audience with the king. He merely said, I wish to do my king and my country a great service. There was no further explanation. The king, Gustav III, was told of Carl's last wish. The king ordered Carl brought before him, but he warned the prisoner that there would be no commutation of the death sentence. After proper bowing and scraping, Carl stated he was asking no favors, but that he and his brother were offering themselves as sacrifices to the cause of unifying the people of Sweden. The king's anger flared. How dare you suggest that some of my people are planning a revolt? Carl hastily quieted the king. I said nothing of a revolt, Your Majesty. I merely said the people were divided, as well you know. Half of them have taken to drinking this recently imported brew called coffee and think that tea is undermining the health of the nation. Those who prefer tea militantly think the same about coffee. So far, there has been nothing to prove which people are right, if either. King Gustav had to admit that Carl was right. Furthermore, the king was personally curious as to the relative merits or possible harm of the two drinks. He asked Carl what method he had in mind of settling the controversy. My brother and I are as much alike physically and mentally as any two people can be. Every day, give him tea to drink and give me coffee. The one of us dies first, we'll show which drink is the harmful one. Well, the king liked the idea. He ordered that the two brothers live exactly the same and eat the same food, but one should drink tea with his meals and the other coffee. He then informed the nation what he had done, stating that regular bulletins would be issued comparing the health of the two men. The nation watched and waited. The men were given the best of food and care. Many were the bets made as to which would die first. Well, neither of them died right away. At the end of the first year, both were alive and exceedingly healthy. As the first decade ended, both were very much alive. Other decades passed. Finally, Olaf, the tea drinker, died at the age of 83. Well, the now almost forgotten battle of beverages was ended. Thousands of old tea drinkers switched to coffee, although many of them did it to settle old bets or in honor of Carl Erickson rather than in expectation of adding to their years. Nevertheless, the coffee habit became firmly implanted. Until this year, when the United States took the lead, Sweden led the world in its per capita consumption. And now 60 seconds to our announcer. After that, I'll tell you of a man who was condemned in a different way. Here was a man who literally stuck his neck out. Now we meet a man who was not a convicted criminal, but who nevertheless was condemned to torture worse than death. He, too, became the object of what could be called an experiment. Although the result didn't affect the habits of a nation, it did help several of his friends. Back in the days when England was wresting this continent from the Indians, King George II used many of his Scotch troops. Among the bravest of these Scotchmen were the Montgomery Highlanders, and one of the bravest of the Montgomery Highlanders was Alan McPherson. But these men had been trained to fight in open country, and they were hopelessly lost when it came to combat with the red men in their native forests. The Highlanders were ordered to pursue a band of Indians that had been raiding and burning the pioneer settlements. The soldiers progressed slowly, awkwardly, and noisily into the forest. Underbrush snagged their kilts, and vines seemed to reach out and grab them. Soon they were lost and had seen nothing of the Indians. Then, from a patch of underbrush, an arrow caught their leader. Alan McPherson rushed forward but could find no one. He returned to the men, and they struggled on, only to have their second in command fall after receiving an arrow from nowhere. The Indians took quite a delight in their sadistic cunning. They toyed with the Highlanders by picking off the men one at a time until about half the soldiers were dead. Then they surrounded the white men and took them captive. Nothing was said to the Scotchmen, although McPherson noticed that one of the braves seemed to understand their conversation. The Highlanders began to hope for some kind of a future. Perhaps the Indians were only going to hold them as hostages. Maybe they were going to adopt the whites into their tribe. Other wild guesses were made, but they were all wrong. After traveling through the forest for several days, they came to the Indian village. Squaws and children stared at them as they were led to the wrinkled old chief. He gave his orders. The Highlanders were fed, then their hands and feet were bound with rawhide thongs. The next morning, the captives were fed again, then tied to trees at the edge of a clearing, facing the center so they could see everything that happened. One of the Highlanders was released and led before the others. Then the Indians went to work on him. The red men were masters at producing discomfort. It's better to skip the details, but the discomfort soon was increased to unbearable torture. Finally, the victim was mercifully delivered from his pain. He was glad to die. As soon as he was finished, another was chosen. The Scots tried not to look, but they were so trussed that they couldn't turn their heads. And when the Indians saw a prisoner closing his eyes, they prodded him with knives. One of the Highlanders tried to avoid the torture by holding his breath until he smothered, but the Indians prevented that. A prod in the stomach, and the prisoner involuntarily gasped, filling his lungs with air. Several of the Highlanders had met their tortured doom when Alan McPherson was led to the center of the clearing. Before the captors could start giving him the preliminary going over, he waved his hands, then pointed to his mouth, to the Indians, and to his ears. The brave who had been listening to their conversation, the white men, was called upon. With perfect English, he asked McPherson what he wanted. The Scot answered in a tone of authority. "I know the secret of a powerful medicine. Any man's body, when rubbed with this medicine, will resist the strongest blow of a knife or tomahawk. If you kill me now, the secret will die with me." When McPherson's words were translated, the Indians voiced their disbelief, but they were also curious. The chief had the interpreter tell McPherson to prepare the magic medicine. McPherson explained that it would take some time and that he must not be rushed. The Indians agreed. Well, he didn't know one herb from another, but he examined different plants, taking a leaf or two from each one. He demanded bark taken from special places on trees. He dug up roots. Then he had fish brought before him and took a few scales from each one. He insisted on fat from animals which were hard to catch. Well, finally, he could stall no more. He put the mixture in a pot and had it simmer for a day. The Indians gathered around when he declared it was done. He said he would prove the medicine himself. The Indians and the captive Highlanders were gathered in the clearing around McPherson. He grabbed a handful of the gooey mess and rubbed it all around his neck. Then he lay prone upon the ground and called the interpreter to his side. "Take the sharpest tomahawk you can find and strike me on the neck where I have rubbed this big medicine. Your men will see that no hurt will come to me." The Indian took a tomahawk and wailed away, but the medicine didn't work. The Indians stared at McPherson's lifeless body, then at each other. Finally, it dawned on them what had happened. The white man had escaped the lingering torture by assuring himself a clean death. The Indians had no code of sportsmanship as we know it now, but they admired anyone who got the best of them, whether by courage or cunning. Since there was no way of showing that admiration to McPherson, they showed it to his remaining comrades. They were excused from further torture and later released, some of them living to get back to Scotland to tell of the bravery and slyness of Alan McPherson. Well, the period for our brief visit behind the curtain of time is over. This is Harlow Wilcox thanking my writers, Charles Crowder and Thurston Hoffman, and inviting you to join me the next time we take a peek into history, this time to join the Klondike Stampede.